In 1 year of the opioid epidemic, 2016 to be precise, the United States lost more people than it did in the entire 19 years of the Vietnam War. And so we pause to ask, how can we manage our pain without killing ourselves with opioids?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,149th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Aberdeen who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, we look once again to our opioid crisis, a crisis that is like World War III in the cities, towns, and villages of our nation. In just 1 year of this war, we lost more Americans than we did in the entire 19 years of the Vietnam War. In our first look, which was Food Chain Radio number 1138, we learned that what happened when a 13-year-old fell off a trampoline and into an opioid addiction that took his family through a decade of opioid hell. In our second look, 1139, we talked with professionals whose job it is to bring back people from their opioid addictions and all that they must go through with their fight against those addictions. Today, we go to the front lines of the opioid war to meet two doctors who are revising how we treat pain so that we can deal quickly with the pain and avoid addiction. And ladies and gentlemen, I know what these doctors are doing is working because I am their patient. And so let's meet the doctors who are on the front line. We'll start with Dr. Nicholas Abidi, who is an orthopedic surgeon of Ortho NorCal in Capitola, California. Doctor, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Orthopedic surgeon. What do you do when you're an orthopedic surgeon?
So orthopedic surgeons go through 4 years of medical school and then do a general surgery internship and then 4 years of orthopedic surgery training, which involves treating the musculoskeletal system. So that can be neck, back, arms, and legs, and feet.
Mm-hmm. And I am your patient. What did you do for me?
I don't know. You have to sign a HIPAA statement. I'm not sure if I can convey that. No. So obviously we're talking easily about it. So what we did was a knee replacement.
Mm-hmm. So you chopped my leg in two, and then you put it back together with a new knee in it.
It's kind of a magician's trick, yes. We sawed you in half without cutting you in half.
Okay, and how many saws did it take?
Yeah, so we used a couple of saw blades and some drills, and we basically, it's like sterile carpentry, as one of the other doctors likes to say, and luckily I really like carpentry. We line up your knee with your hip and your ankle and resurface the end of the thigh bone and the top of the shin bone with metal and plastic and put things back into alignment.
So you did a lot for me. You gave me a new knee.
That's right.
Chance to walk again.
That's right.
Without pain. Also with us, Dr. William Morris, who's an internal medicine and palliative care doctor working with Dominican Hospital, Dignity Dominican Hospital in Santa Cruz, California. Welcome aboard.
Welcome.
Right up with that microphone there. There you go. Good. Internal medicine and palliative care. What is that, palliative care?
Well, palliative care is the specialty of medicine that really helps people at the end of their life, making mm-hmm. sure that they stay comforted and have the best possible quality of life. And it's usually for patients who are facing life-threatening illness.
Good. And I was also your patient because I was at your hospital and went through your hospital so quickly, I'm not even sure I was there. Zoom, it was quick. So you're working with Dr. Abidi on ways to manage pain without getting addicted to the opioids. And that's a tough assignment.
It is. And I think we're learning more each year that we go through this and realize that this is a problem. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, we got to use opioids. Opioids are crucial medicines for controlling severe pain in the hospital. So we're not saying that opioids should not be used. What we're saying is that we need to use them correctly and recognize when they become a problem for patients.
Okay, I'd like to back up a little bit and talk about pain management. Because when I learned I was going to have a knee surgery, I freaked out because, of course, I didn't want to get addicted to opioids. And so I was going to tough it out and do it without any medications. But my son-in-law, who is a medic with the U.S. Army, with the U.S. Military Special Forces, said there are numerous studies in which people who are suffering pain recover much quicker if they manage that pain. Dr. Abidi?
Right, that's a great topic. As we see that patients actually who don't have a stimulus or a noxious stimulus and are on pain medications tend to actually be the ones who might get addicted. But that patients who do have a short-term stimulus and take the pain medicine are the quickest to get off of it once that stimulus is over.
And does it also not help you recover from whatever is causing the pain? For example, I have a knee operation. So using pain medication for that really helps me recover from the pain and the injury.
Right. There's two ways to look at that. One is that we preemptively loaded your case with medication that actually addresses the pain receptors and your body's perception of it and decreases your body's shock to undergoing surgery, the gabapentin. Also, the anti-inflammatory medicine decreases the inflammation from the surgery to a little bit, both at the nerve level and within the joint. And then some of the other medicines like Tylenol and Tramadol preemptively treat the pain as well within your brain and your brain's reception of the pain so you don't develop a violent reaction to it. You also need a lot less pain medicine in that case because we're addressing those issues within your brain chemically.
Well, yeah, that was an awesome cocktail right. that you cooked up for me, and I'm going to go through that a little more thoroughly as we go get into the program here. But first of all, what happened to us? Dr. Morris, how did we find ourselves in such an incredible fix with respect to opioids?
Well, I mean, there's
I'm blaming it all on you guys.
Yeah, well, we're partly to blame, I think, because we're the ones that wrote the prescriptions, the physicians. But, you know, also there was a lot of factors, I think, that people think contributed as well in that, you know, there is some people wanting to make a lot of money in the pharmaceutical industry. So they were mm-hmm. prescribing a lot of, or developing these medicines. And
what was the relationship between you and folks like Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the makers of oxycodone? Did they bring flashy salespeople to your office and say...
Well, certainly they did. I mean, mm-hmm. I think for many years we had a lot more of that, didn't you? And what'd you say, Nick? I mean, we had people coming in, you know, usually attractive young professionals that would bring in food for the office staff and do a lot along those lines to get some time.
Make
to speak
everybody
with us.
Smile.
Make everyone smile. And then drop off articles that were favorable for their painkillers and encouraged us to prescribe them. And certainly, you know, we're busy physicians. We're trying to get in and out of the each, you know, get through the day. And it's a lot harder to sit down, really work out the cause of someone's pain and appropriately prescribe than it is to just write a prescription for an opioid. And it makes the patient happy and they go.
Now, I understand one of the pitches made by people like Purdue was that it's very important to get ahead of the pain. Dr. Abidi?
Right. So having been in an academic center, we actually weren't allowed to have, and I never really wanted to have a lot of drug lunches, as they call them, because I was at an academic center before I came here called Jefferson during that first rollout. And even in our current office as orthopedic surgeons, we don't have a lot of drug companies actually coming to us. We have implant companies that we work with, mostly surgical companies. But the drug companies never really approached us. But in our academic literature, the major centers in the United States were probably approached by those areas, like Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic and Hospital for Special Surgery. They developed pain protocols, which we ran at the time, which involved layering patients preventatively with OxyContin. Not codone, but content from Purdue. We were also told from New York, one of the hospitals in New York, I think it was NYU, that there is another vital sign that we're ignoring, and that was put through our training programs, and we were told to pay more attention to that. It was even added into the hospital quality outcomes measurement scores called HCAPs that were just backing off on that in not promising patients a pain-free episode, but reducing pain. That there will be pain, but we will try to minimize that in a safe and effective manner rather than turning them into zombies.
So when I first went to the Dignity Dominican pre-operation class, which is put on for people who are going to go through the class, and we all sat down, and everybody was very nervous. And so without thinking, I asked out loud, "Does it hurt?" And of course, that cracked up everybody because that was what's on everybody's mind. So I guess that's where we're going today. Does it hurt? Of course it hurts. How do you manage it so that you don't end up living on it? We're of course talking about the opioid epidemic and what it's caused to, what happened to our country. My goodness, more people died in 1 year of the opioid epidemic than the full 19 years of the Vietnam War. How are we going to come to grips with managing our pain without killing ourselves with opioids? That is the question on this edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We have Dr. Nicholas Abidi, orthopedic surgeon, Dr. William Morris, and you right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're talking about the opioid epidemic and how we're going to go about getting control of it. And we're talking a little bit about how the doctors, of course, of our nation were approached by those who were selling opioid medications. And a lot of persuasion going on there, because there was a lot of money being made. And when did we come to grips with the fact that we're going a little bit overboard on that, Dr. Morris?
Well, I think it was in the end of the, 2010, 2012, we started to, at least it became more evident to me that that bad things were happening. Up to that point, it was sort of like, well, we may not be doing the best with controlling pain, but, these medicines, we were told, were safe, and if they were prescribed effectively and appropriately, we wouldn't get into trouble. But we started to see bad things happening.
Like what?
Well, like people dying. People dying. Ooh. Like you were saying, you're pointing out that so many people have died from opioid overdoses, although, often while I say that to my patients, they'll say, well, it wasn't me. I wouldn't ever die. I've been on these medicines for, 10, 20 years now, some of the patients that I see, and I would never die. But they say that it's going to be people that are using illegal opioids like heroin. But I think what we're seeing now is the combination of opioids plus other things like sleeping pills, anti-anxiety medicines, medicines that also suppress the brain and the breathing are a deadly combination.
Wow. There are a lot of things to take, I guess, to get you into trouble. When I went into this, I started with nothing because I wasn't taking anything of any kind. And so when I started in the medications, I didn't know. They were pretty confusing stuff, and I had no desire to continue them. That was it. But somehow, some people who are more susceptible to it than others, Dr. Abidi?
Right. Actually, well, Bill has pretty good data on that. But if you look at the number, I think was 26% or 28% of the U.S. population can take medications like Vicodin or oxycodone or narcotics, and their brain receptor doesn't really process it, or it doesn't make them suppressed. And it creates other issues like dependency and addiction issues. So they actually don't get pain relief out of a normal dose. They require something else to control their pain. Their mu receptors are different. And that's not uncommon. It's a big number, actually, of patients who are susceptible. Patients that have a history of addiction potential, alcoholism, and other issues in the family have genetic issues, and they have to be really acutely aware of that. That their pain may get out of control, or they may become dependent on medicines before it helps them. And those people need to be aware of that and try to stay away from narcotics.
Backing up a little bit, what did we do before we had these miracle drugs to get rid of our pain?
Well, I graduated from medical school in 89, and that was about the time that we started to really start to push these opioids more, or at least we were encouraged to. I think that before that, people just sort of got through it. Huh?
Well, so my dad's a doc, my father-in-law's a doc, and they trained in the 60s and 70s. And my dad still prescribed for headaches. He's a headache specialist, actually. And a lot of those patients that I took care of in Pennsylvania were addicted to pain meds also. So there are other medicines that were phenobarbital or other type of medicines that were connected with a narcotic or had a hidden name. And patients were highly dependent on that as well. So that it wasn't really as prevalent, but nevertheless, it happened. It just the medicines weren't as potent. So OxyContin is really potent. The sustained-release medicines like OxyContin and Dilaudid really didn't come online until a little bit later, and fentanyl as well, which is short-acting but very potent compared to morphine. These other medicines, you'd have to take a lot of them to overdose, and they would wear off very quickly. It was the longer-acting medicines.
The difference between OxyContin and fentanyl, and there's even ones even more powerful than that, as I understand it.
Right.
The same thing, or they're all synthetics, right?
Yes.
And, of course, being the clever people we are, we can figure out how to make them really powerful and really frightening.
Right. Codeine started, and then synthetics, because there were allergies, plus codeine may have had reactions or not be as potent, resulted in manufacturing of other medicines. You take less of it, it would last longer. That was the theory.
So did you as doctors, as doctor, get marching orders someplace along the line from, I don't know, the federal government or somebody that said, hey, we got to get control of this?
You mean in the first place to control the pain or to back off on the pain meds?
To control the pain meds so people weren't falling over dead all over the place.
It's been a slow reaction, actually, in terms of organized medicine. They've brought it up. We have something called the Cures Database, but really within a community, we have starts with a community county medical society. We go through CME courses to be educated on pain control. At the time, originally, those pain courses told us we weren't doing a good enough job. And now the pain meetings that we ran, similar to that, are because we've read in our different specialties, different literature, plus our personal experience with management, says that we were seeing too much. And I personally were weaning patients off of the medicine before surgery. So in the orthopedic literature, we were publishing data from the Rubin Institute in Maryland and other places by reading the journals saying patients who are on chronic narcotics before orthopedic surgery do poorly afterwards.
Wow. So if you're on these things, you shouldn't be on them before you get an operation.
That's right. And those patients did much worse in many different outcomes measurements. So I personally wrote...
Because they didn't have a pain reliever,
that's
right?
That's right. No, not just that, but it correlates with other poor nutrition, poor appetite, poor multivitamin intake, low albumin, low self-esteem, many issues which are similar to depression. And when those patients are measured in their outcome, they can't do the rehab, they can't walk as far, they become dependent on many things.
And as a doctor, you're always looking for good patients, I suspect, right?
I mean, we want to try to help people to be good no matter what.
We don't always have a choice.
Yeah. So it's usually the good patients are the ones that don't show up. But there you go.
That could be.
So I'd like to take a little bit about what you're doing to change how we go about this whole process. And it seems like the first thing that you're doing is working with knowledge and teaching people. I mean, when I went through my knee operation, a tremendous amount of information was given to me about what was going to happen and where there would be pain and the causes of, and everything. I mean, what question do I have that needs answering? They were there to answer it. How much does that knowledge have to do with making it easier to bear pain?
Depends on you as a patient, your personal experiences, your pre-existing superstitions, your cultural background, your level of trust. What we find a lot is that patients don't have good coping mechanisms. They're not going to do well no matter what we do. If someone has an underlying anxiety disorder or a poor family structure, it's hard. We try to help them as best as you can with the class and neutralize or identify those people and give them more support. Not everyone needs the same level of support.
Right.
Some people need more. Some people need less.
It kind of goes back to if you're taking bad drugs to start with, you're going to be in trouble no matter what, right?
Right. Things like trazodone and anxiolytics and Valium and stuff like that and Ativan, we have to be careful because people can use them as a crutch rather than talking through things and addressing issues ahead of time to resolve them before you go through the knife.
Inflammation is pain, right?
Can be.
I mean, that's what my experience has been. My knee got the size of a watermelon, and that's where the pain was.
So you had chronic inflammation ahead of time from arthritis, from enzymes which are in the joint that your body's white blood cells manufactured, mm-hmm. and you had friction because the cartilage went away, and you got cracks in the surface which created a chain reaction. We can control that inflammation by injections or medicine ahead of time, but your genetics and your activity level predicate what's going to happen to you in many cases. And you went to bone-on-bone arthritis and were developing dysfunction. You're walking,
yeah.
night pain, rest pain, back pain, really losing your muscle mass and becoming less active.
That's but when thankfully, I ran into Dr. Nicholas Abidi, right. and there was hope for Michael Olson, who can now walk again and right. kick some butt,
right.
too.
But I think, Michael, you were at low risk, I think, for addiction yeah. or problems with an opioid use disorder to start with, because you weren't on opioids. You had managed to have your deal with your arthritis for how long?
3 years, four years. Yeah.
And you weren't on opioids. Now, yeah. you're a totally different type of patient.
Well, that's for darn sure. That's what my wife says. You're a totally different kind of person. Folks, quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to the doctors about what we do now. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, if we can't do opioids, what can we do? Well, Dr. Nicholas Abidi presented me with a whole range of medications, and I'm glad I had a good nurse at home, my wife, because it helps to have somebody keep track of these things for you. So I'd like to go through with these different kinds of drugs that you provided me, because I think they really negated the need for opioids. As I said, I took a few opioid capsules, OxyContin, or what, is it OxyContin?
Codeine, short
oxycodone. Okay, right after the surgery, but I quickly got off them because I simply didn't like them. But so, take us through the spectrum of things that you're working with, doctor. So starting with gabapentin.
Right. So let me talk about, there are two different types. Dr. Morris can talk about chronic pain management with okay. other modalities that don't involve surgery, because surgery is an acute event. He'll talk about acupuncture and things like that,
sure.
potentially, if you feel comfortable doing that. But in terms of surgery, number one, we prep you for it, so you're prepared mentally, and that's an important part of the class.
That's the mental part, yeah.
Coping mechanism, you're calm, you're at ease without synthetic medicine. The other is that any human needs to be sedated and have medication to prevent a reaction, your blood pressure and pulse that can result in a bad surgery. Before surgery, we start you on gabapentin, which is an analog of a transmitter in your brain. We're not sure exactly receptor-wise exactly how it works in every patient, but we know it's similar to brain neurochemistry. It calms you down, creates less reaction in your nerve cells. Number one, we start that ahead of time. Tylenol and tramadol and Celebrex are also used. Tramadol is also a mixed action pain medicine, which reduces the risk of addiction.
Is it a narcotic?
It's a mixed action, so it's not really truly. It has both a positive and a negative reaction. So it's classified as a scheduled narcotic, actually. But it has the equivalency in pain control to Norco and hydrocodone, but mm-hmm. it doesn't react the same way and doesn't have the same addiction potential. It has a risk of habit formation like anything does, but less likely to do that.
Right. And the big one, Tylenol.
Right. Tylenol is a painkiller. The American College of Rheumatology, first-line drug. It's not an anti-inflammatory. It's a simple pain medicine. Anything can be habit-forming, but Tylenol generally is not habit-forming.
Right.
If you have normal liver function, it's the greatest medicine for pain control.
And how did you come up with this cocktail?
Right. So we looked at, with two of our anesthesiologists about 10 years ago, the different cocktails that were available in the United States, because we were fed up with the narcotic push 10 years ago.
Wow.
And I deleted from their protocol the OxyContin, actually, from Mayo Clinic and Hospital for Special Surgery in Rush. We did a consensus literature search, and then we used every medication except for the OxyContin. And we found very good pain relief with the anesthesiologist using regional anesthesia, meaning numbing medicine in the spine and the leg, and then using those medicines for prevention rather than giving heavy narcotics.
And the other kinds of pain medic management, you were talking about all kinds of different modalities then, right?
Well, you know, the acute surgery, clearly it's crucial to deliver good pain control because how are you going to recover afterwards? I think the problem often occurs is that, you know, for instance, like you were a patient that you took your oxycodone and you didn't really like it. My wife, when she threw out her back, she was given some Norco in the emergency room. She said it made her feel sick. So, you know, you take that patient, they're at much less risk of getting into trouble with taking of opioids. But if you take the opioid and you go, wow, this makes me feel good, then you're in trouble. So how do we deal with that? How do we deal with those patients who say, well, I need more than two oxycodone. I need a day. I need 2 days. I need 2 weeks. I need 2 months. That's the trouble. How do we recognize when people have gotten into a problem with opioids? And that's what we're trying to do better at.
And everybody's different. So how do you do better at
that? Everybody's different. How do you do it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that just like I like to say, you know, we need to recognize when something has failed. And opioids fail just like any other treatment. So how do we recognize it? We have to be alert to some patients that have increased risk, like Dr. Beatty said, that have a genetic predisposition because they have a family history of getting into trouble with substances. Some patients show it to us by their inappropriate use of the opioids. Some show us because they have horrible side effects that we can't manage, the worst of which would be they stop breathing. That's a horrible side effect. And yet,
just about the worst, right?
It's about the worst you can do. And if you survive that, I still have had patients who say, I want to keep taking my opioids. And when you continue to want to do something despite harm, that's what we call opioid use disorder or addiction.
Mm-hmm. And when you spot the addiction, what do you do?
Well, I think we have to be more honest with our patients that this is really, we're seeing that you have an opioid use disorder, and we have to talk to them about that and say, look, this doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means that you have a disease that we have to deal with, and we can manage it. We have good treatments for opioid use disorder, but we have to improve our access to them and get more people trained in how to do that.
And therein lies the difficulty, too. What about the families?
It's hard. I mean, people still, families and patients themselves, judge themselves. What did I do wrong? How am I such a bad person that I've developed a problem? And we, again, have to go a long way in trying to improve the stigma that's attached with these medicines and say, look, when you get into trouble, we're here. We're part of the healthcare system. It's a medical disease. Let's deal with it.
Call for help.
Yes.
You know, that was the interesting thing in the story of the young man who fell off the trampoline and ended up with a decade-long habit. The family went through everything they possibly could to rescue him, but they just couldn't. And so they had to call for professional help. And the same thing is true with the those who help people get off. It's just got to find professional help or you're not going to be able to do it if you're that kind of addict.
I mean, I think it's like diabetes. You know, diabetes, you wouldn't try to manage without a doctor's assistance. I mean, you may exercise and eat really well and manage your diabetes, but that's rare. Usually, you need to go to a doctor, sometimes an endocrinologist, to help get your diabetes under control. And substance use disorder is no different. It's a chronic relapsing illness.
And therefore, if it's chronic, it's chronic, and you got to fight it. So are you getting support from your institutions in this fight?
I think Dominican in many ways. I mean, with Dr. Beatty's innovation and trying to get people off of opioids before they go for surgery.
So this is really a big innovation then, getting people all cleared up before you go in for treatment then.
It's a lot of skepticism. I think that, let's back up for 1 sec. I would say from the ER all the way to the primary care to ortho, when you prescribe a narcotic, you have to tell people that it's addictive potential, and you have to limit the number of pills you give. And we've tried that, and it's met with skepticism. This talk show plus other public service announcements are very important, just like tobacco. Addiction is a problem, and it needs to be out there just like tobacco to give the patients that. Because when you tell them that, some of them still are not aware of what's going on, surprisingly.
And a lot's going on. Well, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the impact opioids have had on our nation. Oh, my goodness. 1 year of opioids, 60,000 people were killed. Killed in action, far surpassing 19 years of the Vietnam War. When will it end? It's going to end when we take the means within our own hands and deal with it. And that's exactly what we're doing with these doctors today. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to ask where we go from here. This is The Food Chain. Do stay tuned.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at MetroFarm.com.
2x2. Get two friends, do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at MetroFarm.com.
2x2.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And so how do we deal with a nation of opioid addicts? And you hear about them everywhere, big cities, small towns, villages. It seems to be just about everywhere. And I'm sure most all of us have experienced it, friends and family. We've seen what happens. We've seen what happens when the addict loses control, and all of a sudden all of the things in the household start disappearing and ending up at the pawn shop. My goodness, what are we going to do? How are we going to save those lives? It's so precious, the people that we're losing. So let's talk about how we come to grips with it. And Dr. Nicholas Obidi, you had an idea that we need to do more of public announcements, right? We need to get out and fight.
I would say the analogy was the smoking and the tobacco industry. When I was in training, we had much more vascular disease and pulmonary disease in Pennsylvania than we do nowadays, to the point where, boy, vascular surgeons almost don't exist. We have mostly non-invasive type vascular surgery. And the same thing goes true for the opioid crisis, where this is what the Surgeon General is for. This is what a community health officer is for, is addressing a pandemic, which is now how we're addressing this, is an epidemic or a pandemic, and it's a public health crisis. So we need public service announcements and education in schools at a grassroots level, and to get started with that so that we are not defending ourselves in the exam room all the time. We don't want to be defensive. We want to treat patients in an appropriate fashion. So this is really where your public health training comes into play.
Doctor?
I think, too, it's important to recognize that, you know, I see a lot of patients in chronic pain, and a lot of them have gotten onto opioids in the last 10, 20 years.
So a little distinction here. So I have short-term pain, you know.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. You know, I had my legs chopped in half and put back together.
But you had potential for chronic pain pre-op, and because you don't have those issues genetically and you're normally functioning, you were able to get through it in a normal fashion.
Right.
There's some people who head into an alternative pathway with that and come in on narcotics and other issues, and they don't get that healthy outcome and don't have that healthy relationship with their pain and their medical issue.
Gotcha. But I had short-term pain.
Mm-hmm. You did.
And you're talking about chronic pain, which is pain that just doesn't go away.
And doesn't go away, and then in trying out of desperation to do something, patients turn to their physicians who then might prescribe opioids. at increasing doses is what had happened in the last 10, 20 years.
Because a little bit worked to start.
Yeah, and then it wore off.
And then it wore off, and you need more. And the pain won't go away. And
right, so that's we get into this dangerous cycle. And I think that the patients that I see in my clinic that I point that out to and say, look, you know, you're on this high dose of opioids. They're not working. And a lot of patients will say, yeah, they're not, but no one's offered me an alternative. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things, fortunately, we can do sometimes replace joints, and that helps. But in some patients, that's not an option, or they get their hip replacement or their knee replacement, and it doesn't help much. So those patients, we have to say, look, we need to get you off of opioids. We need to wean you off if it's not working. Just like any other treatment, if it's not working, we stop it. Some patients tell me, I can't wean, there's no way. So then we offer an alternative. And the alternative that we're increasingly turning to is a medicine called buprenorphine. Buprenorphine is a partial opioid agonist, and it can help control pain as well as be a lot safer. Now, the goal is to not necessarily develop a nation of Suboxone or buprenorphine-dependent patients, but at least in the short term, we can switch to this medicine safer and then over time try to taper off.
Seems like the big player here is the patient. I mean, patients really have to come to grips with their condition, whatever their condition is, whether it's a short-term surgery or a long-term chronic pain, but the patient has to be willing to fight it out too.
You know, I've never seen a patient on chronic opioids who is not petrified about the thought of coming off. And I think that Dr. Abidi has so much success because he can offer them surgery. But to just tell someone, opioids have failed you, we got to get you off, that's a hard sell.
What do they do?
About 25% of the patients that I see in my clinic do wean off.
And then 25%?
About 25%, which surprised me when we first started trying to do this. Then a good probably 70%, maybe or less, can switch to buprenorphine, which is a different drug. And then we have a certain maybe 10 or 15 that walk away and that don't want to change. And those, I think, are addicted.
And when you no longer prescribe them medications and they're still addicted, what do they do?
Well, I think that's a good question. We worry that they turn to illicit drugs.
Street drugs.
And I think the jury is not settled on that. I mean, I think that there's a concern that that might happen. But, you know, I don't know if it really does as much as the press would have us believe.
Does it ever?
I think it does. It certainly does. Like the earlier talks that you've given, you know, that there's that young man who ended up going from prescription medicines to illicit drugs, and that right. does happen. But I think that the majority of patients it doesn't happen for, but they continue to get their prescription medicines even though they're not working for them.
And they do that by going to one doctor or going to two doctors or going to three doctors or going all over town.
They can. Sometimes when we switch people to this medicine, buprenorphine or Suboxone, their pain is better. It's improved as well as increasing safety. So we're trying to improve our capacity to do that in our community.
Okay, we're going to up for one more quick break and a few more minutes left. But something Dr. Abidi said, I think I saw it in a film clip, and it was just a brief suggestion, and it was permissiveness. He mentioned the word permissiveness. Got to ask him what that means. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy. You can do it. Metro Farm it. So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, so much to talk about, so little time to talk about it in. One thing I heard Dr. Abidi talk about, and it just kind of threw the term out there when discussing, you know, how we got into the situation, and that was permissiveness. What did you mean by throwing that word out, permissiveness, Dr. Abidi?
Right. So I think that what we worry about is placating, or rather than addressing an issue, sometimes enabling a problem. And permissiveness means it's okay to take a pill, perhaps rather than addressing something with the right treatment. Physicians go through a lot of training and scientifically, and you should try to trust the doctor, if you could, who's got that specialty or background certification. There are plenty of physicians out there with board certification and specialty certification. Talk to as many as you need to, but really find out what the issue is before you go on narcotic treatment, and address the problem without narcotics if you can first.
You said it should be a last resort. Narcotics should be the last resort. And that's kind of how you set up my prescription, my medication regime. You handed me the box of, or the bottle of oxycodone, and said, this is for when you can't take it anymore. So I didn't get there. Maybe I did for a minute or two, or took a few, but I didn't go there because I just didn't need to. But how do you tell somebody that? There's got to be other ways of addressing it.
Education, and making sure they really understand for their level of education and what their needs are. And making sure they have the right environment where they can really treat things effectively. So, you know, it's always better to have a family member there who you trust when you go to these visits. It's really delicate information, and you may be completely thrown for a loop by all the information. You have to be able to absorb that. If you need to go back and talk about it again, do that. A pill isn't the right answer all the time, or an injection isn't the right answer all the time. You got to take a deep breath. Step back and realize even after surgery, there are other ways of treating things.
Dr. Morris?
I guess I would like to speak to those patients who unfortunately have found themselves dependent on opioids after, you know, 10 years and 20 years of being given them by the doctors that are caring for them.
20 years?
20 years. I would like to say, you know, first of all, I'd like to apologize on behalf of the healthcare system that we did this, and the pharmaceutical industry. And I think that there were a lot of forces that led to the excess use of opioids in our country. And I think that, you know, doesn't mean you can't get off of opioids or you can't deal with them. And I think you need to just be honest with yourself. Have you lost control of opioids? Are they even doing what they're supposed to be doing? And if the answer is that they aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, giving you pain control and good function, you need to go to your doctor and say, look, these aren't working. Let's talk about an alternative.
We have a minute left. Where do people turn? Is there a source of information?
Well, I mean, I think that I would say go to your primary care physician.
Go to your doctor.
Go to your doctor and say, look, these aren't working. I think they're not good for me, and I'd like to get off them. Help me get off them. If you don't know how to help me get off them, then please refer me to someone in the community who does, whether it's an addiction services agency or a colleague that has experience with transitioning someone to buprenorphine.
Dr. Nicholas Abidi, orthopedic surgeon, Dr. William Morris, internal medicine, palliative care, Dignity Dominican Hospital, thank you both so much for joining me and for taking care of me. You're my doctors.
<That's> right.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting
Thank you very much for having us.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live. Ba-doom-ba-ba.